the Million Dollar Mortgage Experience Podcast.
All right, welcome to the podcast. I'm here today with Daniel Skolnick. He is an entrepreneur, respected developer, affordable housing leader, also founder of CEO of Atlas West Group. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John.
Absolutely, man. So you started in Wall Street. Is that right?
I did. I had a pretty interesting background as to how I got started in real estate. You know, it actually predated Wall Street. So I started out as a mortgage loan officer in 2006. You know, nice. I was a young guy coming out of high school.
Perfect time. It was perfect, like you breathe on a mirror and you
just breathe on a mirror and just figure out how to make money. If only it was like that.
Right.
You know, I always had an issue with large institutions. I wasn't a great student in high school and I loved business. And so I had a buddy who was making a lot of money in loans. He kind of showed me what he does. Said, great. I'm like, I could do that. Wasn't crazy about going to college. Just again, didn't like the idea of having an institution. And, you know, I like to kind of live my life outside the box. So, yeah. I got my real estate license when I was 18.
Cool.
Okay, it's 2006.
Right out of high school.
Right out of high school and started as a loan officer. You know, I worked at a small boutique loan company. Cut my teeth there for about a year. Learned how to do mortgages. Finally built up a little pipeline. You know, it takes a little bit of time until you got, you know, some credibility. And
especially as an 18-year-old, you're like dealing with someone's financing.
100%.
Yeah, they're right? Like, and who's so this kid?
You're kind of fighting an uphill battle because you're a young gun and you're going up against many more seasoned people, but you look through tenacity, a lot of hard work, figure out how to make money in mortgages,
yep.
You know? And I was also always a deal junkie. I love to do deals. I love the art of business. And, you know, towards just before 07, so it's like end of 06, you know, I had a couple houses in escrow I was buying with a buddy. And at that time we were borrowing money from our real estate commissions, our mortgage commissions to put them together to build the houses. We didn't have any money. You know, at that time it was all 100% financing. It was still, you know, it was the heyday of.
You were scrappy.
We were being really scrappy, right?
Yeah.
So we're walking to work and, you know, back then you had these crazy loans that paid, you know, like premiums on the back end. The higher the rate, the more you got paid.
Mm-hmm.
We walk into work the next day, interest rates are 13%. There's no rebates. The market's tanking and we've never seen adversity before. Like, what the heck is going on?
Wait, this is like late 07?
This is late 07. Yeah.
This is
now 07, you know? So it was the Lehman collapse.
Yep.
Right. And so I learned at an early age that adversity really does happen in business.
Yep.
It's not always hunky dory or a bed of roses, right? Things change. And so that was really my first run with adversity in business, you know? So it was a big one. It was a big one.
75 years in the making, smack right in your face.
Smack in my face, right? Yeah. And so, you know, this whole can't lose mentality was out the door.
Right.
We ended up not being able to buy those houses. Mm-hmm. You know,
probably better because then you would have foreclosed.
It was a blessing. Yeah. It was a blessing. Yeah, yeah. We had zero down payments. I mean, we were young guns trying to scrap things together. And I was out of a job, right? So no houses, mm-hmm. no job. You know, I'm now
and
maybe,
no pipeline
and no pipeline. I mean, there was nothing on the horizon.
It was dismal. I remember those times for sure.
It was. So you know, I come from a family of immigrants. So I'm first generation American. My family's from Ukraine, and college was always a big thing for them, right? And I was the one fighting against it. My sisters all went to college. I was enrolled in school at that time, but I was. I mean, I was taking it real slow. I mean, I went there through hesitation just to make my parents happy, you know, but thank God, because look, the market changed, the world was imploding, and I kind of hunkered down on my studies. You know, I mean, being an entrepreneur at that time obviously was my dream, but there was no business to be had. You know, the world was melting down every day. There was worse and worse news. So I was actually studying finance. You know, I took a little bit of time off from work trying to figure out what my next move would be. But being a finance student, I got a job at Bank of America as a banker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes
what year is this? 08?
This is 2008, like gotcha. End of 07, 08.
Yep.
You know, things are still melting down, but now everyone knows it's actually bad, right? The unknown is gone.
Right.
Now everyone knows things have changed for the good.
Yep.
And so the silver lining was I was at a branch where there's a lot of high net worth people. And at that time, people were moving money around. You know, from bank to bank, you know, CD rates were going crazy because every bank was trying to attract liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, that saying.
Kind of like right now.
Like, kind of like, you know, history repeats itself. Like,
right.
Here we are. So I had a great experience at the bank. I was opening accounts. I was advising on, you know, different investments within the bank, doing referrals to wealth management. I was just, you know, I was just ingrained in that, studying finance and doing this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, roll forward 6 months, 9 months, you know, things have really settled down. And all of a sudden, flips are a big thing. You know, bank-owned properties are a big thing.
REOs.
Yeah. REOs, right? And through my contacts at Bank of America, I was able to get access to some REOs, which, you know, having known who had money, where and for how, where, how much, and what their plans were,
sure,
it made it kind of easy for me to leave the bank and start selling real estate to these high net worths that wanted to do deals,
mm-hmm,
right? And so that was really my first foray out of banking, out of mortgages, into real estate.
Yep.
And I was just a real estate agent. I was selling people's deals, predominantly bank-owned stuff, maybe some short sales. And then, you know, look at anything, you get a little itch, right? Like, well, if they're doing it, why can't I do it?
Right.
And then we started flipping homes. So I was finishing up my degree in finance. By this time, I had a pretty decent sized operation flipping homes. We're buying a lot of properties every month, flipping them and turning them, right? At this time, we're still not buying anything on our own account. We're buying, fixing, flipping, right?
Right.
I ended up graduating with a finance degree. You know, there was a textbook and a course I took on M&A and banking. And I said, wow, you know, this, mm-hmm, whole world of private equity, investment banking, and Wall Street. I'm like, we're sitting here flipping little homes. These guys are buying massive buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks a lot more exciting, you know? And right. So I got that little tick of like, there's bigger and greater things to do.
Sure.
I had some savings coming out of college for my business. And I made the tough call to my parents saying, hey, you know, I'm graduating when I think it was August. I'm like, I'm moving to New York.
Was it like 2012?
2012. You know, mm-hmm, the line kind of went silent.
Things are starting to get a little better out there.
They're starting to get better, but yeah, it still wasn't, you know.
These, it wasn't bright gangbusters yet.
It wasn't, yeah, gangbusters. Occupy Wall Street was really strong at that time, you know.
Remember that, yeah.
We didn't see it this time. We don't see it this time around, but back then, that was a big thing, right?
It was, yeah.
The banks were still laying people off because they were the devils of the time, right?
Yeah.
The banks messed up. They got bailed out. Everyone lost money because of the banks. Obviously, this crisis today looks very different. The banks are strong. But at that, yeah, time, Occupy Wall Street was still marching all over New York. I tell my parents, hey, I'm moving to New York. I've saved up some money and I'm going to get I'm going to get this lavish job on Wall Street buying huge buildings. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm maybe 20, 21 at this time, right?
Yep.
I'm still a young gun.
Mm-hmm.
Probably had a little bit more arrogance than I should have. Get to New York and, you know, I get a beautiful place in Soho. I've got my girlfriend there with me. And we're spending money like we were before, you know, we're still going out, having fun.
Right.
Because again, that idea of like, hey, it's all good. Like we rebounded, like, yeah, we know what we're doing. Well, it was pretty tough to get a job. Okay. I thought the next day I'd be on Wall Street, you know, buying buildings.
So isn't this like Occupy Wall Street where like kids were trying to get out of, you know, they're getting out of college and then, yes, they have no job.
Right.
No one was hiring. Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was
so a blowback. So you experienced that firsthand.
Oh, I saw it firsthand. I mean, I couldn't get interviews. I got to the point where I had a suitcase with envelopes, with hand-addressed resumes, and I had to break in all the buildings to hand-deliver these resumes because they weren't, yeah, even accepting online. Like,
man.
And I had the mentality, like, look, I just told my family I moved across the country.
Yeah.
You know, I gave up some success in San Diego. Like, I got to make this work.
Right.
You know? And I went to great lengths to do it. And it ended up taking me about 6 to 8 months to finally land a job.
Wow.
And by that time,
you learned some perseverance during that time.
I
learned
some perseverance. I mean, I was running up and down Wall Street with big backpack, sweating, breaking into buildings, trying to get a job. It was not an easy time.
Man.
Yeah. But I finally landed a job at a real estate private equity firm.
Okay.
That was buying, you know, large buildings throughout the country.
Okay.
And it was an incredible experience. There I learned asset management, acquisitions, really institutional real estate, right?
That's cool.
I mean, and I saw it in a light that I would have never seen in San Diego, just flipping little homes, right?
Yeah, I bet.
You know, it was really then, I stayed there for about a year, and unfortunately, they also succumbed to the pressures of the market. You know, the company ran into some issues, they had to lay people off. They offered me a position which was not, you know, forward-looking position. It was really more asset management. I like the acquisition side. I'm a deal guy. I like, mm-hmm, you know, I like being in front of people, creating value.
Yep.
And so kind of at a crossroad. I'm like, I got the experience I wanted. You know, I'm also not someone who likes to be within an organization. I like to grow my own organization. And
sure.
So it was a great time for me to come back to San Diego. I got the experience I wanted. And this was now 2013. I'm going to say about middle end of 2013. Came back to San Diego. you know, reconnect with all my old contacts.
I bet you it was like in the heart of winter too. You're like, fuck this, I'm going back to San Diego.
Of course it was. That did not help. You know, the weather never helped. Yeah, but I'll tell you, I think everyone in their 20s should go to New York and cut their teeth a bit because
yeah, it makes you stronger, I'm sure.
It makes you stronger. You see the world. You know,
you're not in a bubble like you are, or you're in a different bubble, maybe, right?
Yeah, but it's diverse.
Yeah,
it's challenging, but it's not challenging in the sense where it's a miserable life. It's just challenging that every day it's a grind, it's a hustle.
You meet and everyone's that way, right? Yes. Like, there's nobody just chilling at the beach, just doing that. They're all like hustle, hustle, hustle.
The amount of intellectual capital I was exposed to left me so thirsty for more because every conversation.
Yeah,
was somebody with a story from somewhere else, and that was
and the bar was kind of set high. I'm very sure. High. Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so I ended up coming back to San Diego, and that's when I started my company. Back then, it looked a little bit different than it does today. Of course, you know, we came back. The environment was a little bit different. We were focused on building a property management platform, which then would grow into an investment and development company. But we really needed to hunker down. Build the team, build an infrastructure, and the best way to do that was to have some recurring revenue. We started out building a management company, and from there it spurred into doing deals. And so we started buying apartments, commercial, mixed use, industrial, really every asset class you can think of in real estate. We've dabbled in it, and at that point we were just really opportunistic, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't platform driven. It wasn't a grandiose macro strategy. It was, can we find the deals? And if the deals make sense, let's do them.
Interesting.
And it was a really interesting time. We did a lot of interesting projects, but also to scale something like that wasn't all that feasible because you had to be so nimble and you had to dive so deep, right? As an investment manager, it's not about how much money you can make on a deal or how well can something go. You always focus on how many things have to go right for you not to lose money. The number one rule in investing, right?
Don't lose money.
Don't lose money.
Right.
And so when you're doing deals of all different types, the calculus that it takes is pretty exhausting, right?
I'm sure, yeah.
And so we ended up selling our company in 2019, the management company, and divesting from most of our commercial assets. We did really well, you know, knock on wood. It was right before COVID.
Good timing, yeah.
People say, you know, we had good timing, but sometimes it's better to be lucky than smart.
Yeah.
And so we sold that company and really transitioned into being a multifamily developer. And that's what Atlas West Group is today. Mm-hmm. We are predominantly a multifamily developer with a primary niche of urban infill. And our business is pretty unique because we're very programmatic.
What's urban infill? Is that kind of like density?
In a sense. So we basically buy underutilized properties and transform them into apartments.
So like it could be like a fourplex and you make it into a 20 or 30 unit.
It could be, yeah. I mean, I'd say a better example, it could be a small structure in a large lot, which we buy and then build units in the back. Mm-hmm. It could be a small commercial structure with a large lot, right? It runs the gamut.
Near some, not residential, but other like multifamily kind of.
Correct, yeah.
And the zoning's there already, you just see an opportunity.
Yeah, zoning is there, is always there. You know, we typically stay away from projects that require complex entitlement because also in our business, time is money and time kills deals, right? And so we like to work on projects where the zoning is in place and we can really focus on creating the value. Mm-hmm. And so we're very programmatic, we're production-based, which means we now pretty much build the same thing over and over again. And that's allowed us to really tease out any, you know, deal-specific risks and just focus on buying great lots and building multifamily units.
That's cool.
That's where we're at today.
How many units typically are you doing?
So we typically have about 100 units in production at any given time. That's pretty much
like
our pipeline.
On one property, like what's your...
Our model?
Yeah.
Anywhere from 6 to 10.
6 to 10, okay.
Yeah. Awesome. So we build, so at any given time, we'll have at least 100 units under construction, but they're bifurcated between numerous properties that are 6 to 10 units.
Nice.
The permitting times are usually much faster than building 100-unit project. You also eliminate concentration risk, right? One project, you know, a lot of times you have one project and you've got all your eggs in one basket.
Yep.
We don't. We get to spread that out. And we also get to bring on unique projects throughout the city versus just one neighborhood that can benefit from our project, which for me is the exciting component because you get to work with various elements, but you also get to build beautiful buildings that you know people like because it's a proven recipe. At that
right,
point.
Right. And it's always cool to like see something you're like, oh man, this used to be a little old tear down house, and now look at this freaking beautiful.
100%.
You know, not condos, but apartments or whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'll give you an example of a project we're breaking ground on next week. You know, it was a 650 square foot two bedroom, which is a small two bedroom. Okay.
Yeah.
On a 10,000 square foot lot. So when you talk about
like a yard, like it used to be in the old days when people had yards.
If only it was a yard, you know, this had weeds everywhere and a bunch of junk piled in the back. But yeah, and that's a great example of the type of projects we do. It was like, we get to buy that and then we're actually going to redevelop that into a 10 unit building.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of value we create, plus how we activate that neighborhood. And also, look, San Diego is suffering from a pretty bad housing crisis.
Yep.
You know,
yeah, so that's why the density thing is a big play. Well,
density is a big thing.
Because they'll prove those right pretty quick. Like the
those types of permits get approved much quicker than, you know, call it a 40, 50, 60, 100 unit building that needs to go through entitlement. You know,
sure.
So those projects that you mentioned that are, you know, call it traditional multifamily,
right,
much broader spectrum, they take about 4 years from start to finish.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Long time.
Yeah.
And that's how that housing is locked out of the market for 4 years.
Right.
Our projects take about 2 years from cradle to grave.
Mm-hmm.
And so half the time, it doesn't cost less. I mean, you know, when you're building something, the sticks and the bricks are the same.
Right.
But time is money, the carry costs, and all that translate into more affordable housing too.
That's good. And what kind of financing is out there for that stuff? Do you go into like a bank, like one of these regional banks, like a First Republic or something to get financing, like get construction lending? Because I know you probably have to do... You got to tear the thing down, got to scrape it.
Yeah.
Then you got to get like, you know, the permits, plans, all that stuff. But then you're going to get, you know, a construction loan and then you get permanent. Because I know you don't really flip. You just sort of, you hold.
We
right?
hold, yeah.
So you're going to probably get some kind of permanent financing. I know you probably use Fidelis for some of that.
Use Fidelis for a lot of it. Yeah. We love Fidelis.
Right. And then after that, you do the takeout with more of a bank or is it more of an institution or how does that?
Yeah. So It's why I always say I'm really loyal on the way in our project and mm-hmm. less loyal on the way out. And what I mean by that
is... Who has the best pricing, right?
Right. Like on your construction loan, on your construction loan and your acquisition loan, I'm really loyal to the people who have always been there for me. I'm not mm-hmm. shopping them by a quarter point here or there. Why? Because the relationship matters. They're taking the bet on you as an entrepreneur, as a developer.
Right.
And so I value that, right? And so we're really loyal on the way in. Mm-hmm. Now on the way out, it's another story because the truth is banking is fluid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today, First Republic could be the best, you know, best in class for this type of deal. But tomorrow, the picture can change. The landscape can change.
Yeah, someone
else.
And
it's Chase, or it's C3, or it's Endeavor, right?
Right.
And so we've got a process where we work with a broker that typically brings us a matrix. I mean, we're 15 to 16 lenders when we're finished with a project. And that's really rate-based and term-based, right? And
right.
Maybe there's situations where we want a shorter loan or a longer loan, and we'll balance that with the program and the rate.
Sure.
But we're really intensely shop that on the takeout.
That's
because
good.
You're not married to them for typically 5 years.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, and then you know that really matters for your overall, like, you know, your numbers, you know, as far as investment return and all that. Because
massive.
That's where you're gonna stick it out and make all the real money, right?
100%.
That's cool. So what makes your company different than other apartment developers?
Yeah. So I'd say my company is probably a great representation of my personality. I like to be out of the box.
Yeah.
Right. So most development companies they'll do a couple of projects or they'll work in a particular geography. We really marry, tried and true construction practices where if you look at the stuff we build, it's all been engineered to be efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, you know, a certain amount of floor plans that we know work on lots in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
We get to Tetris them in, right?
Yep.
And we know those are going to be built efficiently because we've got, you know, I'll give you a great example. Like where you put your bathrooms in your kitchen. Well, if your kitchen's over here and your bathroom's over here, it's not very efficient in construction because now your wet walls are in different places.
Sure.
We'll set up where the wet walls are the same. And so by doing that, we're able to cut costs. We're also able to build faster. And a big part of what we do that's really different is we really get involved in the policy side.
What do you mean by that?
So we work closely with the city of San Diego and a couple other jurisdictions that we're working on passing some innovative housing policy on new programs because, you know, building multifamily has been around forever, right? Housing people.
Right.
But it was a very nascent industry until I'd say the last 5-6 years where the housing crisis became an issue. Affordability really became an issue all throughout California.
And the city really wants affordable housing. I mean, it's a mandate, right?
They do. It's a mandate. Well, it's a state mandate, right? And so it comes from the state, gets pushed down the cities. Most cities have some leeway into what programs they can or can't opt into. Mm-hmm. But look, San Diego's been a huge, huge winner of the pandemic. And I say that, you know, not lightly. I get it was a terrible time. A lot of bad stuff happened. But look, it was a change agent. So where you see, you know, negative migration throughout California, San Diego has tremendous positive migration.
Right.
Right. So we need to bring on about 12,000 housing units a year to keep pace, not beat it, not for prices to go down.
Just to keep pace.
For us to keep pace, we're averaging about 4,500 new housing units a year. So if you look at that imbalance, things were broken. So, you know, policymakers, this goes back to the Falconer administration, really worked on creating some innovative housing policy where they took what the state has done and they went a step further. They were really leaders, you know, now on a national scale. So we're in conversations with the White House and some programs that are looking to roll out nationally. Hmm. We're in conversations with Newsom's administration on how do we can further implement more housing throughout California. And so we get involved in those conversations. So we don't come in later and figure out, okay, what can we build and what should we build? We really understand what's good for a city, what's good to solve a problem, right? Because for me, it's like, just doing something can be thankless. Like if tomorrow, you know, the mortuary business was booming, I don't think I'd be developing mortuaries. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's not exciting.
It's not exciting right. And it doesn't really solve a problem, right?
Yeah, that'd be a bad thing to have booming, right?
You know what I mean? It'd be a bad thing to have booming. But like, and maybe that's a bad example.
Everyone has to die, but just hopefully it's not more and more and more, right. faster,
100%.
Right?
And so that's not our business.
That'd be bad for real estate too.
It'd be bad for real estate. So our business is really about marrying innovative housing policy with creative construction practice, and that's how we're really different. And we do that well.
And that's cool that you're like drilling down into programs that the state and the city, you know, the county, whatever is putting in place, because I'm sure that helps from a financing perspective or even from just a profitability perspective, because if the city wants that and they'll help move faster, time is money. But also I'm sure there's programs where they maybe subsidize certain things. I mean, I'm just guessing.
Great question. So yes, so traditional, a lot of what we do is an affordable housing component.
Yep.
Okay. We are the first developer in the state of California to do what we do with absolutely zero subsidy. So we take no public money. And the reason we're able to do that is because the legislation has changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can build them faster. You can save costs on doing that. And therefore you don't need public subsidy. And that's a big thing. Because once you get into the public subsidy world, you've got more hands in the pot.
Yeah. Okay?
The project takes longer to do. They get more complex. And the average...
Ask more questions.
Yeah, it opens up that can of worms.
Complicated, yeah.
And I'll give you a great example. The average affordable housing project that has subsidy takes at least 4 years to get permitted and end up costing about $500,000 a unit.
Wow. Okay? It's supposed to be affordable.
It's supposed to be affordable. Now, the reason it is affordable, because it's subsidized.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's more efficient.
Kind of like how the insurance companies, you know, and the pharmaceuticals, it just costs more.
It costs more. Now,
instead of being more competitive.
Correct. And now, like, who picks up that tab is another story.
The taxpayer,
right? Yeah. Someone's picking up that tab. So it's not necessarily good for the greater people.
No, it's just a racket.
Yeah. So we deal with projects with absolutely zero public subsidy. We have to do that through policy work.
That's
and we're also building half the time and half that cost.
And so they pass kind of on to you more speed as a subsidy.
Totally.
So you're getting to, and so they're just like approving it quicker, right?
Yes.
And they're saying, because you're doing this type of, and you're not asking for money, we're going to just approve these plans quicker, let you do your thing, kind of stay out of your
way.
That's cool. That's a cool model.
It's a very cool model.
And you stumbled across that, or are you guys kind of like masterminded that?
I mean, the policy was spearheaded through, you know, legislators, right? It was staff and elected officials within the cities and counties and, you know, in some form, the state.
And I think you said Faulkner?
Specifically in San Diego.
Right.
Most of our innovative housing policy started spurring out of the Faulkner administration. Now, like, look, Gloria's administration has taken that. They've done extremely well with it. They've even turbocharged some of it, right? Mm-hmm. And they've doubled down on fixing this issue. But yes, I mean, it predates this administration. However, you know, we get involved typically, you know, through the implementation of it, because policymakers can come up with a great idea. Sure. But if the mechanics for implementing that don't work, and the only way you know that is if your boots on the ground.
Yep.
And so we get involved usually later stage to make sure the mechanics work mm-hmm. and the ideas can actually get, you know, put into action and come to fruition.
Yeah. So what's going on with the homeless situation here? I know we're probably better than other cities, yeah. but gosh, it's just gotten bad.
It's gotten really bad. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny that everyone brings up homelessness during a housing conversation, but like right. they really
it's not a homeless, it's not a housing problem, it's a drug problem. It's I think, a drug and mental yeah, health
or it's right. a mental health problem, it's a drug problem, it's a
but is San Diego trying to combat it with housing, or are they combating it with like a multi-prong approach? Do you know,
it's a multi-prong approach,
yeah,
right?
I mean, that's and the best way to do it
100% you know, because like you see now, you know, that a lot of COVID labs are getting converted for temporary housing, and
yeah.
you're seeing some you know, motels being converted for homeless housing. I mean, the programs are there. I think the city's biggest struggle is getting the adoption, getting yeah. the word out to the homeless population, actually having a plan to implement that, right?
And you almost wonder, like, do they want to be in a house? Or, like, do they rather just be around the drugs and the... Because you can, right? You can put them in a house, but then it's like... Yeah. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I think the analogy is, like, you can you know, you can give a horse water, but you can't make it
right,
drink.
Right, right. That's kind of what I'm alluding to, because yeah. it's the problem hasn't gotten... I mean, no matter how much money these cities spend, it just gets yeah, worse and worse. So whatever they're doing is not working. And... I just feel like that's because it's a drug problem, not a housing problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely, I think how, like, I think there's a resource there, maybe not to solve all of the homeless issues.
Right.
But there is a lot of resources to move the needle of homelessness.
Right.
You know, the city's done a lot.
I mean, and the state's got a ton of money to putting into it. And it's just not helping.
It's not turning the needle. And yeah. I think they've got to change their approach. It's got to be some kind of, you know, like, it's got to be more of a nurturing program than a, let's just push you into here, right? It's got to be, yeah. first of all, I think you've also got to prohibit the behavior. Like, hey, you can't be in the middle of downtown, you know, where you're trying to create a vibrant...
Smoking crack.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Or sleeping on the street, yeah.
That doesn't work. So I think, first of all, you've got to kind of, you know, you kind of got to, you know, crack the whip a little bit and say,
right.
no more, not here.
We're not going to tolerate it.
We're yet. Not going to tolerate mm-hmm. it. And then maybe from there, there's got to be an apparatus that can help people get into all these various initiatives.
Yeah.
But it's a complex issue, which frankly, I don't have the answer for, or else I'd be right. jumping up and down saying,
you'd
hey.
You'd be running for office?
I'd be running for office. You know, I don't have, it's a tough issue that I think everyone's just going to try. I don't think it's ever going to be solved. You know, yeah. it's just about doing a little bit better.
So the people that use the affordable housing are just because it's really almost to the point of, housing is so expensive in San Diego and in many cities that there's just no way to, you can't afford it on a it's wage. Insane. Like you couldn't work in San Diego and live in San Diego
yes.
based on the housing costs.
Yes.
So the city comes and subsidizes to, it's like Section 8.
It's not.
It's not.
Actually, we know. So Section 8 is, we don't build Section 8 housing. No, anyone with Section 8 can apply.
So talk about that real quick. Just because it's not a homeless, we're talking about the homeless issue. But obviously, they're not going to be able to afford a house because they don't have a job, right?
No.
But the people that have jobs, that where housing has become so expensive, I've seen like places for rent apartments for $3,000. I mean, you're like, there's no way someone that's a waiter or that's working at just a job that's a blue collar or just even a white collar job that's not paying that well. Like, how do you afford to live here? Yeah. So how does the city help?
That's a beautiful question because it's such a it's such a complicated question because like.
Right.
The landscape of housing,
yeah.
it's not one box fits all, right? So like you have housing all the way from figuring out what to do with homelessness all the way to luxury, right?
Yeah.
The space that we really focus on is workforce affordable housing. So our tenants, they make 80 to 100 grand a year,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like a lot on paper, but that's not a lot in San Diego.
It used to be a lot.
It used to be a lot.
Until of inflation, right?
Yeah. So like our properties look nice. They're luxury. We've got beautiful finishes. And our tenant base is military. It's nurses. It's librarians.
Mm-hmm.
It's police teachers. Officers, teachers. It's like the fabric of San Diego.
Right.
And why we believe in that so much is because if we don't create a solution to keep those people here, we're going to lose them to other cities. And just like San Diego.
And they're all moving, right? They're all moving east towards Texas east. Or Idaho, wherever, right?
And so we needed a solution in San Diego to keep not only those people here, but the generation, but the next generation in San Diego. So we don't have a flight of intellectual capital and of craft and artisan work to other places, which honestly—
It's happening, yeah.
It happened. I mean, look, we lost a lot of intellectual capital to LA, New York, Chicago, for people that wanted to be in the corporate world, because San Diego is a city of SMBs, right? Small and medium-sized businesses. We have very few Fortune 500 companies.
Right.
But I think now the city and policy, we can really realize, well, we don't want to lose the fabric of who makes San Diego, San Diego.
Right.
So we've built housing for that segment of, you know, the resident pool, right?
And so does the government help in any way, or is it just that you guys are putting the rental market, like, are you capping your rent?
Yeah.
So that's how you do it.
On every one of our projects, we work with the San Diego Housing Commission, who gets most of their policy numbers and limits from HUD, right? Mm-hmm. So it comes from the feds. They help implement it within San Diego. And so almost all of our projects have an element of San Diego Housing Commission oversight. They're the regulatory body. They're really strict about enforcing the rules. And, you know, not all the units in the project, in any given project, are regulated. A few are, but the beauty is the ones that are and ours, the ones that aren't, you'll never know the difference. And that's the idea. It's not about creating affordable or attainable housing in places where it should be, right? You look at Mission Valley, like, let's just build it all there. Well, San Diego's diverse. Like, and you should be able to live throughout the city if you like Sierra Mesa or you like Claremont or you like, you know, the college area or whatever, right? Yeah, you should have the access to the city, especially if you're working here, you're providing job, you know, you're providing a service here, you're paying the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You want access to the city. And so what we do really provides affordable housing throughout the city with absolutely no geographic concentration.
That's cool.
And that's where the city's headed in general.
Right.
It helps balance out all the neighborhoods.
That's cool. What do you know about 15-minute cities? Is that coming to San Diego?
I don't know much about it. Probably enough to be dangerous over a cocktail, which we're not drinking here because it's a Monday.
It's a Monday at what, 2 p.m.?
Yeah, so, I mean, which, you know, we could be, right?
We drink tequila, right?
There you go. So that's not, I probably wouldn't be the best person to dive into
that. I don't know. I've been seeing it in it all around the, you know, different countries like England and different, and then also some states right here in America. But I don't know. It's just something I want to keep my finger on the pulse just to see kind of where it's headed. But
yeah.
I mean, maybe another conversation over a cocktail.
100%.
So if you were, let's say you were starting out today in this market, cause you've been through that adversity that you talked about, what would you do differently in this market? Like to go out and get business? I mean, right now it's kind of put your working boots back on, roll up your sleeves, hustle. Whereas like, you know, during the heyday, I'd say like 16, 17, 18, 19, like those were some really great years, you know, with financing really low. You know, we had a lot of positive stuff going on in the country. But, you know, today it's just different. Like, what would you do differently today?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really different environment. And I think it's evolving every day. Yeah. So what I tell everyone that I work with is, keep your head up. Mm-hmm. Just know that the highs can always get higher. The lows are never as low as you think they are, right?
Right.
And so, the hat we have on now is, does it make sense, right? In an environment where things are operating outside the mean, right? Right now, just the world, and let's start on a macro level, interest rates,
right.
Okay, we're operating in levels that are outside the mean, right? Mean interest rates on commercial and multifamily paper, typically low fives, high fours, you know, agency debt for homeowners, right? Fannie Freddie stuff. Interest rates are mid fives is the average, right? We obviously benefited from insanely low interest rates over the last 2-3 years, but that's not the mean, right? Yep. And things regress to the mean over time. And so given where interest rates are, the general political environment, right? Things are fluid right now. We're going to be heading into an election season here in the next 6 months. We're going to be hearing a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
And really unemployment, right? I think that's the next big thing to really focus on. And that's something we haven't felt yet. So what my general philosophy is, look at things from a, does it make sense, right? Forget the bubble we're in. Forget the macro. Can you isolate a transaction, a deal? Mm-hmm. Does it make sense? Because do you need all these other things to happen for it to work? Okay, mm-hmm. So that's number. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we start first.
Yeah.
In any conversation, is just in times of uncertainty, focus on things that just make sense, mm-hmm. that are clear A to B. But to touch a little bit on the macro picture, I think that things are going to evolve drastically because we've had QE now, quantitative easing, for way too long, right? Interest rates had to go up. Everyone knew that. No one knew how much or how fast.
It
went fast. I mean, it was a hockey stick.
Lightning
speed. It was unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And we were feeling it. The street was feeling it. Investors were feeling it. Main Street and Wall Street was feeling it.
Yep.
But it wasn't a change agent enough. Okay. I think this banking crisis that we just experienced a few weeks back, which is far from over.
Yep.
I think we're going to see some bad news before we start to see good news.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think that the Fed and the administration did a great job stepping in and making sure that they're not bailing out the banks or just bailing out the depositors.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a fundamental difference
from
past issues. But I think that that was kind of the 1-2 punch is we now see blood in the waters, right? That spooked both Wall Street and Main Street. Mom and Pa's are talking about it. They feel it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the hammer over the head of this, of our, you know, steam economy over the last 3 years is really going to be unemployment, which is going to also be a lagging indicator like interest rates. I mean, you look at, you know, Wall Street Journal, but turn on any news channel, we're seeing not a couple hundred, we're seeing tens of thousands of people being laid off.
Yep.
And we're going to feel that probably over the next maybe 4 to 6 months when severances burn off, unemployment, they start to burn through some savings. And so
credit cards start getting maxed.
Yeah. Getting maxed, the payments are going up. So I definitely think we're in a evolving situation economically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer that things always regress to the mean. You just got to hold on long enough.
Yep.
And if I was starting in business today,
mm-hmm.
I would watch very closely to the people that were in it in the last recession and see what their strategies were. How do they pivot? What deals do they make? You know?
Yeah. What are they doing each day?
What are they doing each day? You know, I think it's going to be really important to...
It might even be smart to get a mentor right now, like someone who's gone through something like this,
100%.
Right? And just listen to them. I mean, whether it's a podcast like this or whether it's just, you know, someone in your office that's got gray hair and they're like, oh, you went through 08? Oh, cool. Yes. Like, what are you doing right now? What do you see? And
you
just being a sponge, right? Like learning and listening and then kind of modeling what other people are doing. That's what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it's very hard to innovate in an environment that's changing because nothing is the norm.
Right.
You know? And I mean, you mentioned mentor. Look, I rely on mentors all tremendously, you know? And they may not even be in my industry, mm-hmm. but they've been around for a long time.
Right.
You can't discount the gray hair.
Right.
Time is everything.
Or the no hair.
Or the no hair. I mean, exactly. Or the no hair.
Because that's also stress sometimes.
Yes, 100%.
And age, right? what about just like learning to invest, right? Everyone's talking about, oh, do we invest in crypto? Do we invest in, you know, in these cloud cloud deals or crowdfunding?
Crowdfunding.
Right, yeah. Like crowdfunding. And, you know, people are looking to put money to work because, you know, let's be honest, people have some money saved, right?
Yeah.
But they don't know what to do with it. And they know that it's evaporating with inflation.
100%.
So like, what's your advice for someone that's just saying like, you know, should I put it in crypto or should I, you know, Dogecoin or whatever?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Right? Like that could be gone in a vapor too, right? So it's like, totally. I love hard assets and I love, real estate for a number of reasons, especially because of inflation. It usually does well. I mean, you never know, but you know, we have a housing crisis. We know that. So it's like, if you invest in real estate, it's usually a good bet, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, not in 08, it wasn't, but, you know, 07, you know, that wasn't a good bet. But I think we're in a different fundamental place now. For real estate,
mm-hmm.
still has some safety, you know, a lot of safety. And historically, it's safe.
Yes.
But, like, what would you do? What would you advise someone that's, like, young, trying to get into investing?
Right. I would start first and foremost is I'd stay in your lane, right? I would do.
What if their lane's like working at like McDonald's though?
Okay, but everyone has a friend.
Right, right.
Everyone has someone they trust that isn't doing that.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't go out, I wouldn't go too broad and I wouldn't put all my eggs in one basket. So
sure.
If I'm, you know, I've got a day to day job, I know nothing about business, deals, investments.
Right.
Well, I would make it my job to find someone that does and try to invest
and
alongside
them. See someone that's been successful, right?
That has been successful, because it's so easy to get lost in the trends, right? Mm-hmm. And
look, and that's how you can lose big. Like,
you lose big.
I mean, when First Republic dropped that one day, I was like, oh, I'm going to buy some stock. And then poof, it went down way more. Right? Like if I put in some money that I couldn't afford to lose, I would have been so sad.
100%.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think if people really just focused on investing in things they know, or with people they know that know what they're doing,
sure,
it would shortcut a lot of pains, because everyone hears a trend, oh, it's Bitcoin. Well, they just jump in and they don't know enough about it, and poof, right, it's gone.
Right.
Right. But had they have found a friend that is a professional trader in Bitcoin, knows how to hedge some of the risk, mitigate some of the unknowns, maybe they would have done better. And so that's my point. It's like, I think everyone needs to stay in their lane and not get absorbed in the next shiny silver thing, because it's not always better. Right.
Right. Right.
And
you don't have to be like, oh, like the smart, I mean, true. Just be humble and go, I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. And you know, this person seems to be successful. Let's put some money with them, or ask them like, hey, you know, what are you doing? Can I mirror you, or can I give you some money to invest? You know,
100%. Yeah, and you see that often. It's funny. It's two industries that everyone thinks they're professional in, even though they may know nothing about it.
Right.
It's real estate and crypto. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, everyone's a professional.
Right, right. Because they watched all those TikTok videos.
There's TikTok. They saw a show. They learned it all.
Well, right.
There's the devil's in the details. It's all in the nuance that you don't know. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that only time and experience shows. And so, you know, when I invest outside of real estate, I only do it into things that I have access to through my network.
Yeah.
Like, I may hear about something that sounds so great, but if they're not in my network, I'm usually not doing that deal, because I don't know it and I don't trust that other person, you know?
Right.
And that helps really keep things within at least some, you know, level of standard deviation of understanding. Where can things go wrong?
You still lose, but you have a much slimmer chance of losing.
You've got some rails on there.
You got some rails on there for sure.
Yeah.
That's good.
So I think that's probably my advice, which I didn't take early on in my career. I learned through school hard knocks, but now having gone through it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm sure.
Do you take on capital?
Take on capital.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. So if someone wanted to reach out and, you know, invest with you, they can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, we take on capital. We partner in a lot of different projects. I like to get my network involved. I also think it's great when people have a stake, you know, within their own city or from outside the city that want to do deals. And so almost all of our projects have people involved in them.
That's cool. So you've talked a little bit about your wins, some of the wins and some of the, you know, maybe, I don't know about the losses, but tell me a story about a deal that went south. I love hearing like failure stories.
Oh yeah, deal that went south.
Because that's how we learn, right?
Yeah,
it's like
of course.
Through failures. But like, what was the... probably the biggest lesson you ever had, like in a real estate deal or any kind of deal.
Yeah, no, I'll talk about a real estate deal. We developed a project in Northern California in 2018-19. Okay, turned out great. Pulled everything. We did everything we set out to do. We executed.
Nice.
We were so happy with it. And then 2020 hit. Okay. And we had 10 tenants.
Trying to forget 2020.
Yeah,
man.
I know. But come April 2020, not a single one pays rent. Okay? So it doesn't matter how beautiful it was, how much we did.
You like knocked it out of the park, got it fully tent, like all the tenants.
We leased it out. We did everything. But it didn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a big kick in the cojones, because I learned that like you can't plan for everything and you have to plan for the worst. And
sure.
That really opened.
How do you plan for that, right? Like, how do you plan for a COVID?
You don't plan for
that. You can't.
But you have cash.
You have to have reserves. Yeah, yeah.
You have reserves.
Right.
You have good relationship with your lender in case you've got to go to them and say, hey, listen, something I couldn't have calculated happened.
Right.
You know, let's have a conversation, right?
Yeah.
And also with investors, right?
Yeah.
So when you have partners and you set expectations, like there, you have a level of, you know, responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, what I've learned through that too, is you have to be really open.
Yeah.
Right.
And communicate.
So,
you can't like
communicate.
Go running for the hills and everyone going, oh, where's,
yeah,
where's Daniel at?
100%.
Can't get a hold of him.
No, of course not. You got to be captain of the ship and you go up and down with that tide. But, you know, that was a really tough situation because it didn't matter what happened in the macro environment, right? Yeah. COVID killed everyone, but like that was our problem. In our world, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so 10 tenants, no one paid rent. It was a lot of phone calls and visits to the project, trying to figure out everyone. All of a sudden, you become an expert in everyone's business because you're like, all right, well, where are your revenues? Where are your expenses? Like, tell me why you can't pay rent.
Right.
You're like,
we know you just got a check from the government.
Right. And so if you're working through all that, right, you're like, right. Well, let's get into the details then. Nope. Like, let's work with what we got.
Did you have any like thoughts of just booting them out? Or how did you?
Did you have
to threaten them a little bit? Or
I mean, there was definitely some tough conversations, but yeah. You know, what you don't want to do is someone to call your, you don't want to say something and someone call your bluff, but you've got, there's no one knocking on your door.
And they're all going to share that, like, oh yeah, he's not, he's just BSing. He's right. They're not going to kick us out.
Yet. Right. So you got to be like pretty tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think at that point, right, in any business, there's time to be tactical mm-hmm. and time to be strategic.
Right.
At that time, it's just tactics. It's just, let's get down and dirty. How can we make it work? And one at a time.
Started paying.
We start right-sizing the ship. But I'll tell you, it was a really difficult time. We had to go back to our lenders and have those tough conversations. Mm-hmm. We had to go to our partners and have those tough conversations. You know, we had reserves.
Yeah.
But we're not going to have distributions until we figure out where the ship is headed, right?
Sure.
And no one likes to hear that, especially when there's other uncertainty happening in their lives, right?
Yeah.
But we went through that and, you know, I guess to share the learning lessons is, you know, have great relationship with your lenders. A great relationship with your partners, and don't assume everyone knows what you're doing. It's important to share the journey,
yeah,
because people will appreciate it. And when you just deliver something, you know, tied up in a bow, but you mm-hmm. were silent, they may not understand what it took to do that.
Sure, or, they would appreciate it.
And their mind may run like, what were they? You know, what actually went wrong? And so the communication, the transparency,
right,
and a lot of tenacity. Is important when things go wrong.
I think that's good lesson all around. Like, I mean, if a mortgage deal is going bad, or if there's some issues, right? Just to communicate with
100%.
Your borrower, with you know whoever's on the other end, versus like kind of retreating and it just gets worse and worse. But if you just communicate, everything's gonna generally be a little bit better.
Oh
than,
yeah, big
you
time.
Know,
big time.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes when things are going south to actually. Be bold and brave and, you know, and just deal with it. That's something that not everyone has, right? I mean, you have to dig down deep and go, fuck, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Yeah.
And you got
to
be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part for entrepreneurs. We're used to winning.
Yeah.
And we're used to facing adversity, usually alone, right? Yeah. Or maybe you've got a partner or a board, but usually it's, you know,
you as take the founder, heavy CEO, on your shoulders.
You take it on your shoulders.
Right.
And it's not natural to be vulnerable and to say, hey, there's a problem. Maybe I want to get your input on it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important when things go south. We, you know, and that was a big, you know, I'd say aha moment for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, in our firm when, yes, it was outside of our control, but our job is to be in control.
Yeah.
And we had to navigate that.
Yeah. So you said earlier that you were, I think it was first generation or second generation?
Yeah, I'm first generation.
So coming here, you know, from Ukraine, you know, for your family wasn't easy, I'm sure. Leaving their like origin, their culture, totally. Their everything, right, to come here. So do you think you learned some of the tenacity and just the ability to survive from your parents?
100% from my parents. You know, we were first generation here. And my parents came here, really, they had nothing. They came with, at that time, you know, they came with their parents, but they had nothing. They had to learn language. They had to, you know, build a life.
Yeah.
And it was tough for them, you know, and now, thank God everyone's healthy and successful and,
right.
you know, but they never forgot that. And at that time, the reason they left Ukraine was Ukrainian Jews. We were being persecuted and basically said, you know, it's time to get out, you know, but they ended up in America, thankfully, but we could have been anywhere, you know? And so
it's
funny now with the internet, we're reconnecting with some relatives in different parts of the world. And you learn that, you know, it's not all hunky dory, right? You got to get a little bit lucky in that journey.
Yeah. Some of them didn't go to America. They went to Europe or whatever. Yeah.
But I'd say a lot of my tenacity comes from those values my parents instilled in me is that,
mm-hmm.
you know, when things are good, appreciate them, but also prepare when things turn.
Yeah.
You know, nothing is always good forever. There's bumps in the roads. You just have to, you have to be prepared to hold on to that. And that's not just speaking from a financial, you know, from a financial perspective,
yeah,
a lot of the burdens we usually carry in business and in life is it's mental, it's emotional, right? You have to have equanimity, you have to have tranquility
sure.
to navigate all the things that happen in life, not to get too high or get too low.
Yeah.
And so look, even to this day, I'm very close with my parents, you know. They're definitely the rock that always, you know, that have good values, and they're very just people that are authentic.
Yeah, that's cool. Is your father still here?
Yeah, I think, yeah. My dad and I are like best friends.
That's awesome, man. It's so cool. Does he have any opinions on what's going on? Like, we don't have to get political.
Yeah,
but
Like,
I mean, because obviously he was there. Did he,
he
lived there when he was young?
He lived there when he was young. He came here. He came to, my parents both came here when they were teenagers. So it was a crazy amount of assimilation.
He's got to have some crazy memories of that whole thing. But I'm sure he has opinions, right, on Ukraine and, you know, obviously Russia and all that. Like, we're... You know, you don't have to get political, like I said, but
well, it's
like,
tough not to get political, but that's okay. I can touch on it.
I'd love to hear your opinion.
It's a political issue, right? Well, let's date it a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Ukrainians and Russians were brothers because they fought side by side in World War II.
Yeah.
So I think this conflict is really painful for the masses of people on both sides because
I'm sure, yeah.
Culturally, they're very similar, right? And then, look, there's cultures all around the world that are all beautiful in their own way, but they're just different.
Yeah.
The Russian and Ukrainian culture is, I mean, it's parallel from the way they celebrate to the way they engage with family, all that. And so I think it's a real challenge for the masses, right?
Yeah.
The average Joe is the one suffering the most of this conflict. You know, our family's view on it is, it's pretty simple that, you know, Russia's an aggressor here.
Yeah.
And it's unmerited. And it's going to be a very difficult war, I think, to end.
Yeah.
Because
so how does it end? I mean, how can you end it?
You know, in a chess match, you can game theory it out.
Sure.
I mean, I've done this with I've done this with you know, my family, with friends. We've talked it out. I've not once heard of anyone a good solution, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really sad because the people that live there in the country, they're the ones suffering the most, you know. Ukrainians are scared for their life. You know, right now, actually, we have a partnership with, my company's a partnership with Jewish Family Services, where we offer them housing while they immigrate here. And so in the last 6 months, we've housed 100 people from 4 different countries. They're not only escaping wars in Ukraine, but also Afghanistan that helped the U.S. military while they were there. And we're now getting persecuted by the Taliban and a couple other countries. And so we feel it firsthand. And sometimes I talk to these people, it's scary, and everyone wants it to an end. You know, I know people in Russia who are suffering beyond explanation. They can't travel. They got no access to banking. They're vilified around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
which is so weird because, you know, Ukrainians and Russians, like you said, they're brothers.
Yeah,
they're family. It's like it'd be like if Texas, you know, if the United States split apart and Texas was kind of like a Ukraine. It was like originally part of the 100%. USSR, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Ukraine. And So it'd be crazy if like Texas and California, you know, or United States was fighting.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a trip. I mean, and certainly has to do with there's stuff that will affect, you know, the global economic
big time
world, right? It's big like time. The money, the inflation, all this stuff has to do with we're pouring money into Ukraine, you know, and I mean, it's way above my pay grade. I just sit there and listen and hope for the best, but there's nothing I can do, right? Obviously, personally, but other than maybe support a charity or organization that brings, you know, refugees. Are there a lot of refugees coming from Ukraine to America?
There's a lot less now than we thought there would be. And
Are they going into like other places like Poland? And
no, so I think what happened, you had this original exodus of people who just want to get out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then as the war prolonged, we're seeing this trickle effect of less and less people leaving. I think they're hunkering down. You know, Ukrainians by nature are pretty nationalistic. They're proud.
Yeah, they want to stay in Ukraine.
And they want to stay.
Right.
And I think we're starting to see more. Now that the war's dragged on, people don't want to be the ones abandoning.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really taking stock right now.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, look, it's a humanitarian crisis. Any way you swing it.
For sure.
It'll probably ebb and flow. It just right now what we're seeing.
Yeah,
is the you know, the level of people trying to leave is a lot lower than it was 6 months ago.
Yeah, just makes you appreciate America, what we have here, like as far as like ability to start a business and be able to start over. I've heard so many stories of people who have come here, didn't even know the language, got into the mortgage business or whatever. They learned, you know, things, and then they were able to be so successful in life. So 100%. It's like, you know, obviously there's other countries that you can do that as well, but like, it just makes you so great, you know, grateful for the ability to, you know, to do that, the democracy and, you know, like, I don't know.
We live in the best country in the world. I mean, that's why people from all over the world want to come here. I think it's, you know, every country probably has its uniqueness, right?
And
I'm sure you love
culture.
I know you like to travel.
I love Mexico. When you said America's best guy, I was like, Mexico's pretty good.
Yes, for its own things, but go start a business there.
I know. I can't imagine. Yeah.
It's really tough. So when it comes to, you know, being able to be an entrepreneur,
Start
a business. And I think what's made America such a business powerhouse is that the rules and the goalposts don't move on you. Yes, there's politics, there's regulation.
We have a really robust legal system.
Right? Yeah. And so, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, the goalposts aren't moving on you that much. Sure. Yeah, of course, we know the environment's fluid, but tomorrow the government isn't
way better than most places. Yeah.
Way better than most places. I think that's such an important element because there's enough uncertainty in business and in life, you know, that you want to at least cement some things that you can leapfrog off of.
Where do you think the economy's going here, 2023? We're at what's April 4th today, 3rd?
Yeah, I think that 23 is going to be a good year for tequila because
always a good year for
tequila. I know, but when you celebrate or when you're sad, tequila can be a friend. But
right.
No, in all seriousness, I think 23 is going to be a change agent year. I think we're going to see more blood, you know, blood in the water.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned,
Rate hike, you think?
I certainly hope not because look, it's such a lagging indicator. We've now have a banking crisis. It's on our hand. It's far from gone.
Unemployment's gonna go up. It's on its way. I mean, it's a lagging.
Yes, it's lagging. And that's why I say, I think 23 is going to be a tough year on a macro level. If for the real estate and mortgage industry, just to dive into that a little bit, for the real estate industry, I think it's going to be a decent year.
Yeah.
Inventory is an all-time low, specifically in San Diego. We've got 2,100 properties on the market in a healthy, normal market. It's usually north of 6,000, 6,000 to 7,000.
People don't want to give up their low rate first.
Boom.
Yeah.
They don't. And so we're not seeing that fracturization in prices and you're not seeing this panic. People have 30-year loans.
And they're affordable. Yeah. Like for them, it's like they can afford that loan.
Yeah.
But if they move, they can't afford because it's a new loan.
100%.
So this created a gridlock, I think, in real estate.
A little bit of a gridlock, yeah. So I think for people, you know, investors, developers, deal makers in real estate, there's going to be great opportunity because you're going to always see that in situational distress or situational opportunity where, you know, deals make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now that the environment has shifted, it also gives people some footing to negotiate. And, you know, everyone knows that we're not going up and to the right by now.
Sure.
And so for the real estate front, I think it'll be a decent year. You know, I don't see valuations plummeting, regardless of what's going on in the macro environment. Inventory is just,
you can't not have plummeting unless there's like either a panic sale or everyone starts deciding they want. Now I could see where, you know, in some second home areas, ski resort towns, it's like, should I sell my second, you know, should I sell that house? Like I made some money on it. Should I list it? But still it's like, I got a low rate, you know, I can cash flow it. Like, so yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I'm with you.
Let's say unemployment kicks up, right? And maybe AI starts taking a few jobs here and there. Right. And you start seeing some higher unemployment numbers. People can't really afford, I mean, maybe they have to sell their house and then move in back in with parents. That kind of stuff could happen. But then does that make more of a normal market? Because it's sure not normal, you know?
Well, I think normal is changing drastically, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I think we're going to see that, you know? And I think that's going to probably, it'll create some opportunity. How it all shakes out, I think it's tough to say.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be an okay environment for real estate investors, developers, you know, people that are doing deals in that space. I think people in the mortgage industry are going to really have to bet on the right clients, right? And they're going to, and if I was in the mortgage business, I would top grade my customers today because.
How do you do that?
Well, I'll tell you. So how do you do that? You focus on the people that need the deals, not want the deals, you know, because if someone's, the amount of work it takes today to get a deal done, from the underwriting perspective, the banking perspective. I mean, you go just, that list goes on and on. It's only getting more difficult. And if someone's going to shop you over a quarter point, it's just not fair, right? You work too hard for that commission.
Yep.
And so I think there's people that need deals, right? Whether they are investors or they're first time home buyers. And there's a...
Well, they have a need, like a pending need. Whether it's a divorce or they have to... Or they need cash for their business or they need, you know, whatever it is. The kids are going off to college and they're, you know, the stock market's gone down. They don't have the funds that they used to have. They need to get cash out of their house.
Like, yeah.
I get it. Yeah.
That's how I would talk to my customers, just to make sure, like, you're not burning your time on the wrong people, because it you know, it's good. But when times get tough, people get dicey, you know, and you know, that surety of, hey, if I'm going to work for 30 days, you're going to want to get paid.
Right. Yeah. I don't like working for free.
No one does. That's for sure.
So you shouted out to your parents. Obviously they've taught you some stuff through the hard times, and any other shout outs, people that have come along the way to help you out in your career?
I've been fortunate to have a lot of people come into my life. You know, I'm part of an entrepreneurs group called EO, where I've met a lot of great people. I think the list would be too long to start naming everyone that's helped me in some capacity. And I would hate to leave someone out,
but sure.
You know, I think that as entrepreneurs, we're on a journey that seems so vibrant and great at times to the outside world, because they see us in our glory when the project, the business, the deal that gets done. But the path there can sometimes be very lonely and very difficult.
Yeah,
with a lot of untold stories. So I would shout out that anyone that's in the business world to join some kind of group where they can, you know, they can have some camaraderie and have a sounding board where they can be authentic, they can be vulnerable. And also those people take stock in your success, right? It's always more fun when you get to a point and there's people that were your cheerleaders, but then also saw you at a time when you weren't at your best.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's huge. Surround yourself with good people.
Yeah. I'd also say probably the most impactful book I ever read was by Ayn Rand, called Atlas Shrugged, which, again, I'm not going to get political, and that's not why I mention it. It's just a book that talks about, you know, adversity, growth. It marries life with business, and there's a lot of learning done through it. It was written by a Russian Jewish author who grew up during communism, right? Mm-hmm. And so she saw the perils of the world. And
is it a movie or a TV show?
So
about that?
They made a movie out of it.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, the movie kills the creativity in it.
Yeah.
I don't know how, when you read a book, I kind of dream up the characters.
Yeah. And everyone always says the book is way better, right?
The
book,
you know, the movie kind of shatters the larger than life feeling some of the characters had.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend the book. It's a tough read, 1,000 pages. Like,
it's a big one. It's like a big Bible. One.
But it's a really impactful book, just because it's written by someone who grew up in a time that was so uncertain. And it takes you through those trials and tribulations.
Interesting, yeah.
And there's a lot of wins, you know?
Yeah.
And look, in the end, it's, you know, we talk about, you know, people get really fixated on the present and the bad news. And I think it's important to also have your head above that, right? Like, understand it's all happening, but that is the norm. Like, there's always something. There's a crisis somewhere. And like, if you just get lost in that, you can have a pretty negative overall.
Oh, it's persona. If you sit there and watch news or like read all the, even like just social media, TikTok, all these things, they can weigh on you. Sometimes you got to just blast some music and roll your windows down and just stop thinking about all the nonsense and crazy stuff in the world, right? And 100%. Then and read a book like Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah. I will also say I would add one more thing.
Yeah.
Who's in your life at that, you know, through your journey is really important. Like, my wife is so supportive of who I am, and she, you know, she's that sounding board. And so I think
that's cool.
Who someone dates, who someone's married to is so important, because you know, when you come home at night and you want to share something, it's important that person has a real opinion. They're supportive of you. And they understand that, you know, there's a sacrifice between business and family. And that's the barbell we all have to play.
Being alone sucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's hard. Like, being married's hard, right?
Oh, yeah, everything is challenging.
It's challenging. So, but then it makes it worthwhile, right? Nothing. They say nothing great is ever, you know, easy, or nothing worthwhile is ever easy, right? Yeah. Because you know, you get through it, and you're like, God, you look back on your however many years you've been married, and you have the kids or whatever. It's like, God, we, you know, we could have lost all this if we would have just said hell with it, you know, but like we worked at it. It was hard.
Yes.
But, you know, so not everyone's lucky enough to have a good partner or find somebody like that. So it's, again, just gratitude, right? Just that, you know, you have a good
100%.
Wife and sounding board and knowing that nothing's ever perfect, but you know,
you gotta
work at it.
Never are. Right. But gratitude and abundance.
Absolutely.
You know, those are really the two big values I live my life by.
That's cool.
Abundance is at the forefront. And sometimes it doesn't always work out. Sometimes I give too much and don't get, you know, and you get burned sometimes, but you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Knowing it'll come around later somehow.
Absolutely. If you're just too tight with your hands and not giving back or anything, something about the abundance is like what you're giving. You're giving, and then you know usually it reciprocates somehow, whether it's through the world, the universe. Absolutely. I think that's huge and key. And plus, it's rewarding to. What's the whole thing? It's better to give than to receive, right? Like it's you get more reward.
That's my personality, 100%.
Yeah, like there's something cool about you know doing that, like especially when it's people you love, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't really care about getting presents, but like when I see, you know, when I give someone a present, it's fun.
It's fun. It's fun. It's fun to get to see the reaction. Yeah. You know that you made an impact.
When I was a kid, I loved presents.
Of course. Who didn't? You know, who didn't?
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, now for me, it's like, it's about experiences. Like it's the material stuff isn't like, I can get a present. It's great. But like for me, it's the experience with the people I love and the people I care about.
So I have a TikTok and we were talking about it earlier, TikTok. But I'm on this TikTok algorithm sometimes where a person will come and like give, like he'll act like they're either homeless. Like, do you have a dollar to spare? Uh-huh. Have you seen this?
I've seen that.
Maybe on Instagram. Do you have a dollar to spare? And they're like, sorry, no. And then another person's like, and then it's like some poor person gives him a dollar and then he gives him back like $1,000.
Yes.
And it's like the shock, the tears. It's like, there's something cool like to see when people give like 100%. That. I don't know. It's pretty rad.
You never know.
You never know what's going to happen.
Yes.
And usually those people are like, oh my God, I didn't know where I was going to get rent this month. Or, you know, I lost my job. And then they're crying. You're like, hopefully this is honest. Like, hopefully it's a true thing. Yeah, it's not like actors, right? Like, I think most of them are true, hopefully. But
yeah,
it's always cool to watch those. And
it is.
Makes me kind of like want to give back somehow, like in different ways, right? Yeah. Like, which we have things we support charity wise, but like, it's just cool to see people do that on a day-to-day basis and it's rewarding.
It is big time.
Totally
big
rewarding. Time. Awesome. And well, I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you for
it's
having me.
It's been super fun. And
it was a blast.
Getting
I enjoyed
to know
this.
You and I didn't know your family's from Ukraine. That's cool. And, different perspective on all this stuff. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. Please like, share, tell your friends about us. We're not going to grow unless you tell them. So please do that, share the videos and the podcast. So thanks again for watching. Check out Daniel Skolnick here. If you want to invest with them, reach out to him. We'll put like a link down there, for everybody. And, thanks again for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, John.
Awesome.
Awesome.
See you on the next one.
The $1 Million Mortgage Experience Podcast.